And it turned out that most people during that outbreak actually got infected directly by working with these monkeys or monkey tissues. But there were also secondary cases, meaning human-to-human transmission.
Virological with Florian Kramer.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Virological. This was recorded on January 24th, 2026 in Vienna. Today we're going to talk about Marburg virus, the cause of Marburg virus disease, which is a hemorrhagic fever, basically meaning disease that comes with fever and with bleeding. And that's actually a pretty severe disease, as you'll see. A little bit about Marburg virus. Marburg virus belongs to the family of filoviruses. It's closely related to Ebola virus and Cuevo virus. Most people are familiar with Ebola virus. Cuevo virus is basically a filovirus that was recently found in Europe. Probably going to make an episode about that one at some point because it's interesting. And the genus Marburg virus has two members, which are relatively similar. One is actually called Marburg virus, and the other one is called Raven virus. The disease that they are causing is basically the same. One is more common than the other, so Marburg virus is much more prevalent than Raven virus. But yeah, the only difference is that they are genetically a little bit different. Both viruses are biosafety level 4 agents and can only be handled in biosafety level 4 facilities, which is basically the highest biosafety level that exists. The virus itself has negative sense RNA genome. It only has one strand, so it's different from influenza viruses, which have 8 genomic segments. For example, in this case, it's just one genomic segment, one genome. If you look at the virus itself, we have the genome on the inside that's covered by a nucleoprotein, which protects the genome. And then there's this complex of nucleoprotein and genome is also associated with a polymerase, and then with two more proteins, VP30 and VP35. VP in this case stands for viral protein. So they're just called viral protein 30 and viral protein 35. Then we have two matrix proteins, one main one, which is VP40, and then smaller one, which is called VP24. And then we have a lipid envelope, so it's an envelope virus. And in this envelope, we have a spike protein, which in this case is called GP, which stands for glycoprotein. The virus particles are filamentous. I mean, that's the family name, right? Filoviruses, filamentous, makes sense. They're elongated. They basically look like a nightcrawler. They're about 80 nanometers in diameter and about 800 nanometers long. This is a little bit shorter than Ebola viruses, which are on average a little bit longer. And the virions, when you look at them under the electron microscope, they often have a U shape or they're shaped like a 6. So basically with one end sticking out and then the other end basically making a circle. The virus has a very interesting way of entering cells and it shares that way with Ebola virus. The virus attaches to the cells and then it's taken up into the cell in little vesicles that are called endosomes. And in these endosomes, the glycoprotein, the GP, is partially digested by proteases. Proteases are basically enzymes that digest proteins. And the digested version of the glycoprotein then binds to the actual receptor, which is in the endosome. And that's a protein that's called Niemann-Pick C1. And that then triggers fusion of this endosomal membrane and the viral membrane. So basically then the virus membrane fuses with the membrane of these vesicles. And what it does is that the inside of the virus can get into the cytoplasm. So basically really inside the cell. And that's then where replication starts. that's basically when the whole infection starts. So how can you get infected? There's two ways, either via contact with infected animals or their excretions. One important animal there is the Egyptian fruit bat, which is a relatively large fruit bat that can be found in many regions across Africa. It's not everywhere in Africa. It needs a certain environment. It feeds on fruits. So you won't find it in desert, but in rainforest areas, for example, you'll find them. But you can also get infected via contact with non-human primates or by consumption of bush meat. And then there's a second way of getting infected, but it's more rare, and that's basically human-to-human transmission. So you can get infected by contact with a person who already has the Marburg virus infection. And for that, you need direct contact to bodily fluids, blood, for example, but also excretions, including feces or urine. Milk can be a way of transmission, basically from mothers to babies. And then similar to Ebola virus, this virus can hide in the body in certain sites that are in a way immunoprivileged, meaning that the immune system is not very active there. And that includes parts of our eyes, but also testicles. And so for Ebola, it was shown that people who survive Ebola infections can have Ebola virus in their sperm, in their testicles, basically, for quite some time, and they can actually transmit the virus on via sexual contacts. And this hypothetically can also happen with Marburg virus. So that's something to keep in mind, which is really interesting with these viruses. The first cells that get infected in our body are cells of the innate immune system, often macrophages, monocytes, dendritic cells. And that's, of course, pretty mean because those are the cells that are supposed to be the first line of defense. And they're also very mobile, meaning that they circulate in the body. And when they're infected, they basically start to distribute the virus throughout the body. Later on, other types of cells get infected too in all kinds of organs. But initially, it's really these innate immune cells. The incubation time of the virus is 2 to 21 days, but usually it's somewhere between 5 and 9 days. And the infection progresses in different phases. Once you have symptoms, there's the first phase, which comes around day 1 to day 5 of symptomatic disease. This is associated initially with very high fever, headaches, chills, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. A lot of people develop a rash, abdominal pain, but also conjunctivitis, so eye infection, and just in general malaise. People feel very, very sick. Then there's a second phase that typically lasts from day 5 to day 13 after infection. Here we see these hemorrhagic symptoms, so basically this bleeding that comes with hemorrhagic fever virus infections. That's not just the Marburg virus, Ebola virus does similar things, but there's plenty of other viruses that also can cause hemorrhagic fevers. So what you see here is often bloody stools, hematomas. So basically you see blood under the skin or bleeding under the skin, bleeding from mucosal surfaces, the gums, for example, nose, from the eyes. Often people are vomiting and the vomit is bloody. Encephalitis can be a symptom in that phase, so infection of the brain and inflammation of the brain. Edema, so basically having swollen legs, is something that you see during this phase, and often people also have trouble breathing. And then you have the last phase, and basically in the last phase, which typically lasts from day 13 to day 21, there is a separation between people who will survive the infection and people who will succumb to the infection. Typically, people who start to recover will still have muscle aches during this phase. They might get hepatitis, so basically liver inflammation, liver infection. They might get psychotic, so there's certainly involvement of the central nervous system. But those are usually signs that people have that finally survive the infection. With fatal cases, usually it goes very fast in this phase. People have shock, they fall into a coma, and they get multi-organ failure and then die. The case fatality rate depends on the outbreak. It's between 20 and 100%. On average, it's around 60%. So if you're infected, your chance of surviving are less than 50%, which is pretty bad. A little bit about the history of Marburg virus. The first outbreak occurred in 1967 in Marburg an der Lahn in Germany. And that's where the name of the virus comes from. But at that point, there were also cases in Frankfurt in Germany and in Belgrade in Yugoslavia. Back then, this was Yugoslavia. And in total, there were 32 infections. I believe 7 people died. In Marburg, they had 5 people who died. In Frankfurt, 2. And I don't think any of the people infected in Belgrade died. There was, of course, an investigation into the disease and what could cause it. There was a team from University of Marburg working on this and a team from the Bernhard Nocht Institute in Hamburg in Germany. And they basically isolated and characterized the virus. But at the same time, Ana Gilgic, Dorlak Institute in Belgrade, also isolated the virus and found the cause of the disease. And an investigation was done and to find out where these infections came from. And so in Marburg, they had the Behring Werke. This is now, I believe, CSL Seqirus. This was, in principle, a facility that was producing sera, but also vaccines. And they used to get regular shipments of monkeys from Uganda. In this case, it was African green monkeys, and they were used to basically harvest organs. And then from these organs, cell cultures were made. And these cell cultures were used for vaccine production, but also for vaccine safety testing. And it turned out that these monkeys were infected with Marburg virus. And the same shipment of monkeys from Uganda was split up, and some of these monkeys went to Marburg, some of them went to Frankfurt, and some of them went to Belgrade. And that was the reason why this outbreak occurred. And it turned out that most people during that outbreak actually got infected directly by working with these monkeys or monkey tissues. But there were also secondary cases, meaning human-to-human transmission. So 3 cases in Marburg were due to human-to-human transmission, it seems, 2 cases in Frankfurt and 1 case in Belgrade. Then over the next years, there were a number of cases, smaller outbreaks basically, in African countries. And in 1987, the first case with Raven virus was identified. This was in Kenya. The infection occurred in a 15-year-old Danish boy, teenager, who was in Kenya on vacation, and he was visiting caves. And it seems that's where he got infected. And unfortunately, he succumbed to the infection. And the virus was basically named after him. I believe his first name was Raven. What is also interesting is cases in 1988 and 1990 that occurred at Vector Institute in Kosovo, in Novosibirsk, in Russia. Those were associated with work on Marburg virus, I believe, as bioweapons. And one person who got infected there unfortunately died, and the second person, I believe, survived the infection. Back in during that time, of course, there was research in the USSR on bioweapons. And the good thing is that this has been now shut down due to international treaties, and nobody's doing stupid stuff like that anymore, hopefully. There were outbreaks with Marburg virus off and on, again, in African countries, usually smaller outbreaks with only a few cases, but there's some more notable outbreaks, one in 1998, from 1998 to 2000 in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, with 154 cases. There's another bigger one that happened around 2004-2005 in Angola with 252 cases. And then more recently, we had in 2023, 40 cases in Equatorial Guinea. And then also an outbreak in 2024 with 58 cases in Rwanda. And there were also more recent outbreaks, but small outbreaks in Tanzania, in Ghana, and in Guinea. And as I mentioned earlier, the case fatality rate varies from outbreak to outbreak. It's usually somewhere between 20 to 100%, but on average around 60%. So a pretty bad infection. Another interesting case or cases occurred in 2008 in Uganda. basically, what they have in Uganda, in some areas, in this case in the Maramagambo forest, which is a park, they have caves where they have a lot of these bats, a lot of these Egyptian fruit bats, and they also have a lot of snakes in these caves. There's actually really cool videos online where you can see the bats flying out of the cave night and snakes waiting outside and catching the bats midair and feeding on them. And so tourists like to go there. There's tours and you can visit these caves. And in 2008, a couple from the Netherlands went to one of these caves and then they went back home. And one of them had been infected with Marburg virus, got symptoms in the Netherlands and unfortunately succumbed to infection. Another tourist from the US had also been at that same cave and went back to the US and got symptomatic disease in the US. Was pretty bad. She was in the hospital. She was not doing well, but she survived. At the point in time, nobody figured out that she had a Marburg infection. But later on, I believe she heard about this case in the Netherlands and she got tested again and it turned out that she had a lot of antibodies to Marburg, basically indicating that she had this infection when she was visiting this cave and then returning to the US. So that's pretty interesting. And I guess if you go on vacation to places like Uganda and you go to caves with bats, you have to be very careful. And so I also wanted to talk about this association with these Egyptian fruit bats, which are actually called Rosettus egyptiacus. And that association was basically figured out between 2007 and 2009. I think there were suspicions before that, but back then I think it was really proven that these bats are one of the reservoirs, potential reservoirs. There might be other reservoirs out there as well. The bats might get infected from other sources, but there's really nice proof that the virus spreads between these bats and that many of them are infected. And so this goes back to, again, Uganda, another cave, Kitaka Cave, to people who work there. I think they're looking or they're mining gold in this cave. And there was a small outbreak there in 2007. And people rushed there to investigate that and then wanted to see how these miners got infected. And they went into this cave to sample the bats. And it's kind of an interesting situation. It's pretty hot there. It's probably relatively tight in terms of space in these caves. I'm a little bit claustrophobic, so for me the imagination of going into a cave like that is terrible anyways. And then you probably have the ceiling of the cave full with thousands and thousands of bats that drop their feces, drop their urine, and that might be full of virus. And you have to get in there fully suited up if you want to do that kind of research, right? Basically a hazmat suit. And what I've also heard is that in these caves you have a lot of snakes, right? Pythons, but also cobras, for example, which feed on these bats, right? And so the situation of going into a bat like into a cave like that, full of bats that are infected with a deadly virus, it's hot, you're claustrophobic, and you also have these snakes around. I'm also afraid of snakes, so that's another factor. I can't just not imagine doing something like that. But these guys did that and actually could show that in this cave, many of these bats, these Egyptian fruit bats, were infected with Marburg virus. But again, there might be other reservoirs for this virus in other species as well. So what can we do about Marburg virus infections? The bad news is actually not much. So there are no specific therapeutics. You can try to treat people who have the infection in terms of their symptoms. You can, you know, provide supportive therapy, but there's no specific therapeutics that you could use. There's also no vaccines, so there's no way to prevent the infections. The interesting part is that for Ebola, we now have these things, right? There's vaccines, there's at least two different vaccines that are on the market. There are more in development. We have therapeutics, which are based on monoclonal antibodies. So if you have the infection already, you can do something about it. And very similar technologies basically would work for Marburg virus as well. So vaccines have been tested in non-human primates, in monkeys, and they do work. There's also monoclonal antibodies that neutralize Marburg virus that in animal models also work. But because there are usually small outbreaks, there's not as much interest in Marburg virus and as much significance there as for Ebola virus, where you have larger outbreaks and more frequent outbreaks. There's not a lot of investment into development of these things. And of course, it's also very hard to develop vaccines or therapeutics if you have only sporadic cases, because you can't evaluate these things properly in humans. And that's needed in order to license them, to bring them to the market. So it's a tough situation, specifically in areas where you can get infected with these viruses. And the hope is that this changes, that vaccines will get licensed at some point and that therapeutics will become available at least to a point where they can be used as a compassionate treatment, for example. Okay, so very deadly virus, no countermeasures, not a good thing. But I also wanted to kind of give you my opinion about the potential of this virus to cause larger outbreaks, large epidemics, or even pandemics. So the basic situation is that if you get infected with this virus, if you get in contact with the virus, that's bad, right? The chances, if you have an infection, that you survive it are probably lower than 50%. There's not much one can do once you're infected. And if you go to areas, you know, where these viruses might be prevalent in bat populations, there's no prevention either in terms of vaccines. Of course, you can make sure that you wear a proper safety gear and you might not even want to go to a cave like that, and then you can't get infected, but at least there's no vaccine that you can take ahead of visiting, right? On the other side, these viruses seem to be not very efficient in transmission, in human-to-human transmission, and that's good. You need direct contact with bodily fluids to get infected, or you need direct contact with these bats or other species, but the virus is not good in jumping from humans to humans. And that means that the risk, in my opinion, that this virus will ever cause a pandemic is very low, because it's also easy to stop. And I think that's the good news. Okay, that's it for today from Virological. As always, if you have comments or suggestions or questions, please just write an email to virological@podcastwerkstatt.com. And yeah, thanks for listening in, and talk to you next week. Bye.
If you're enjoying the podcast and would like to support our work, visit us on Steady. You'll find the link in the show notes. And don't forget to follow and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Podcast Werkstatt.